Found guilty of the murder of a student in Cardiff and the attempted murder of his parents. Jason Richards and Ben Hope were hired to kill a businessman in April 2010, but they went to the wrong address and stabbed Amir Sadiq to death instead. They then turned on his mother and father as they went to save their son's life. Amir's sister, Umbereen, says the family is delighted and relieved at the guilty verdict.
Within seconds, our lives changed forever. The world has moved on in almost 3 years since the murder. But for us, the attack is as fresh as if it happened yesterday.
Two Australian DJs who prank-called a hospital have been told that they won't face charges over the suicide of a nurse. Mel Gregg and Michael Christian posed as the Queen and Prince Philip in the call to the London hospital, which was treating the Duchess of Cambridge. A female police officer has been arrested as part of the investigation into the so-called Plebgate affair. The 46-year-old was present in Downing Street when the former chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, was supposed to have called police plebs. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
Do you think we're living in a healthy democracy? Are you happy with your elected representatives in Bristol, Westminster and Brussels? If so, don't listen to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, 5 to 7, every Friday, with councillors, MPs and MEPs. Followed by investigative reports from 6 till 7, with me, Tony Gosling. Friday Drive Time, 5 till 7 on BCFM 93.2. It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a bomb explodes at the entrance of the US Embassy in Ankara this morning in a country torn between Islam and NATO. We speak to a Bristol journalism graduate who this week has just got back from the Turkish capital. Plus, Israel bombs what are believed to be Russian arms shipments in Syria and Lebanon as John Kerry takes over from Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in the White House. The Israeli intelligence chief, Aviv Kochavi, is in the United States, meanwhile sipping coffee by his side at the Pentagon. Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. And Bristolian Gary McFarlane hit the national news recently. He was sacked for his Christian faith, working for Relate. But does that mean Christians can't do counselling in Britain? No. He's opened his own practice. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 degree Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs up to 7, sunnier but colder on Saturday, some light rain but warmer on Sunday. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, fairly cloudy week with some sunny spells and also windy. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of February. Highs of 9 Celsius, a fairly cloudy weekend with some sunshine and some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest, and it's Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins, that's joining me. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, we're in a bit of a bizarre situation, aren't we, in Bristol, with the election of independent mayor, I'm going to say Lord Ferguson. He's not quite a lord.
You know something we don't?
George Ferguson. But the trouble is, I mean, it's almost entirely stuffed with Liberal councillors. George himself used to stand as a Liberal councillor, and up until just before the mayoral elections, he was a fully paid-up member of the Liberal Party. So,
well, he was a fully paid-up member until significantly after the period of when the election actually got started. He was a member until August, but that's not to say he was actively involved with the
but
party.
But it starts to look, what I'm saying, is like a Liberal Democrat. Nothing's really changed.
No, not at all, no. I mean, basically, George decided when he got elected, he wanted a cabinet of six. He wanted three Labour members, which he provided, you know, left the spaces vacant for some while. But it became increasingly obvious that, he just wasn't coping, because you can't run a city. One person cannot run a city.
Well, one of the reasons that Labour didn't go for that was because he was saying, well, he was handpicking who he thought were the best Labour councillors. Well, that's not his job, is it? It's the Labour Party's job to do that. I mean, one would have thought that if he hadn't done that, maybe the Labour Party would come forward and say, well, actually, these are the people we want in the Cabinet, George, and it's for them to decide as the Labour Party, not him.
Well, I think there could have been discussions, but basically the decision was made for the Labour Party by their rules from head office. Rightly or wrongly, they have a policy of not being involved, and that's what they were told from London. Now, some people will agree with it, some won't, but that's the facts of the situation.
So, but the thing is, he's been elected to change things. Nothing much has changed. I mean, what we're getting now, it seems, is pretty much, apart from the Green councillor, Gus Hoyt, who's now in the Cabinet, we've got essentially a mirror of the Westminster situation now here in Bristol, with a kind of coalition between the Conservatives, that's Jeff Gollop, and Alistair Watson, I think, has just joined the Cabinet, and Liberal Democrats running the city.
Well, no, in actual fact, this administration is completely and absolutely different. When there was a Liberal Democrat administration, what you actually had was people responsible for areas, but on key decisions, we all discussed matters and came up with a collective view on the way forward on issues. That's not what's happening now. What we actually have is a mayor making all the decisions, every one of them, and taking personal responsibility for all the decisions, and cabinet members being there to, we presume advise, but they're not in a position where they can make decisions, and there is no collective responsibility. So completely different situation altogether.
Is it a dictatorship?
I'm not using that word. You might say so, but I mean, basically, he was elected to run the city, and basically, that's what he's doing.
Now, this week we've had the announcement that George has got fed up with waiting for the Labour Party to put forward people or to allow people into his cabinet, and he's brought in. Now, Guy Pulteney, who's a Liberal Democrat councillor, and Barbara Jank, the former leader of the City Council, as well as the Conservative Alistair Watson. Their roles are going to be, Mr. Pulteney is going to be responsible for housing and planning, Ms. Jank will take up health and wellbeing. Alistair Watson's brief will be children and young people. And Jeff Gollop will be serving as deputy mayor. Now, he's already on the defensive a little bit, because in the Evening Post this week, it's The Post now, isn't it? Mr. Ferguson defended his decision to appoint three Lib Dems in his cabinet of six. He told The Post, "I was expecting to have three Labour members originally, so there can be no complaints that the proportions are unfair." That's bringing old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers here. Martin, it really does look as if the Labour Party, by not in any way cooperating, even negotiating with George Ferguson over being part of his cabinet, have shot themselves in the foot. Because you've ended up with actually no Labour people whatsoever in the council, and basically it's a Lib Dem Conservative coalition going on.
Well, yes, I mean, there's obviously quite a lot of ructions inside the Labour Party when the offer was made, and I'm not really party to the ructions that went on. I think that Gary's point that in actual fact this isn't a cabinet in the sense that there's collective responsibility weighed quite heavily on the minds of Labour people. So these because in actual fact there's no votes to be taken. So George is going to decide everything anyway. I mean, in that case, we might as well be the opposition, mightn't we?
Are these essentially advisers? So when Alistair Watson, it said Alistair is looking after children and young people, he's there as a sort of advisor, a word in George's ear.
Well, basically there will not be any collective cabinet decisions. They will not have any individual power, and all the decisions have to be signed off by the mayor.
The other thing is, he's got, it was revealed at the cabinet last week, that he's now got three paid advisors from KPMG helping him, George. I'm going to certainly ask him about this when he comes in, next time he's in here on this show. But what are your thoughts, Gary, about, you know, someone from this essentially what they are is a sort of corporate advice company. They do auditing, all sorts of things like that, financial services, this kind of stuff. Are they appropriate people to have advising the mayor? And also, I mean, he's just brought them in. He's just, you know, these people haven't been elected. It's a bit like the House of Lords or something.
Well, I think there has to be an awful lot of care taken on this in terms of confidentiality of information, see what goes where. And also, you have to look at where people's loyalties actually are. I mean, we obviously have always used sounding boards outside the council, but final decisions have actually always been made by people within the council having listened to outside advice. And clearly this potentially is concerning. Also quite amused actually to find out that, you know, we were going to be saving money by not having a chief executive. We're having a chief operating officer who actually seems to be going to be paid more than the previous chief executive.
What's the difference between having a CEO and a chief operating officer then? What in your mind?
Is it just words? Well, I don't know, because basically at the moment we're told that the mayor is functioning as the chief executive officer and leader of council, so basically two roles together making all the decisions and all the executive decisions. So this chief operating officer is just going to be there to carry out the mayor's wishes rather than operate with a degree of responsibility.
That's a lot of work now, especially looking after whatever it is, 400,000 people and their interests. I mean, is he going to have time, do you think, to get into the nitty-gritty detail when a big stack of papers arrives on his desk?
Well, I think the first budget proposals are a sign that there will be difficulties. I mean, quite frankly, the budget proposals, some of them were ill thought out and showed signs of actually some of the old chestnuts brought forward by officers, which we've rejected, being accepted without too much question.
So they've been sitting on the desk. I mean, you've rejected these things in the past, but they've been sitting in the filing cabinet, and now they've been rolled out for George. Is he? You know, can you give us an example?
Well, a perfect example is the police community support officers. I mean, I've heard the mayor's comments on here. Well, somebody else ought to be paying for that, but quite frankly, the practicalities are in Bristol that we've had wonderful value for money from funding some of those PCSOs and actually got more resources into the city, and they've been a key part of crime reducing in Bristol at a record rate. So they're extremely valuable. They give reassurance as well as doing practical jobs. And to actually say, oh, well, I'm sorry, but at a stroke of a pen, we're cutting those out completely, is just ludicrous.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I want you to answer this question about Mayor Ferguson's three advisers from KPMG. KPMG is one of the largest professional services companies, they call themselves, in the world, and one of the big four auditors, along with Deloitte, Ernst & Young and PricewaterhouseCoopers. They're based over in the Netherlands, and they're under investigation right now from the Competition Commission, who instigated an investigation about a year ago because they believe there was price fixing and deal breaking between these four big organisations. So is it appropriate for Ferguson to be employing these three advisers when they're actually under investigation essentially for fraud?
Well, I mean, you've raised that question. I don't know enough about the detail to say whether it's a good or a bad decision. I mean, you do have to bring in outside advice, as Gary suggests, and therefore there is possibly a case for it. But I'm terribly, terribly suspicious. I mean, we used to have local government that was run by local government officers, which, whatever their faults, they knew what they were doing. They were the people in charge. And bringing outsiders in with the idea that they will always come up with something better. We've tried this an awful lot.
Well, the idea is that these people have got they've got experience of working with big companies, with big business, and at the moment there are big changes going on, what with all the cuts coming in. Possibly they're helping with the implementation of those cuts to say, well, you know, in order to soften the blow of those cuts, they've got to take place here and there, and helping Mayor Ferguson out. We've already heard from Gary that George is not really that interested in the detail. Maybe these are the guys that are going to sort that detail out for him.
Yeah, but the question is, what's the line of accountability for these people and so on? I mean, local government officers, whatever faults they may have, the line of accountability is clear. These people are here today and gone tomorrow, and it's a question of what is their ultimate loyalty, as Gary said.
Gary, what are your thoughts about this concept of bringing in somebody from KPMG when they're being actually investigated by a national body for price fixing?
Well, a number of organisations are come under investigation from time to time. I'd rather concentrate on the fact that I've read some reports from outside consultants that have been procured at quite significant cost, which have quite frankly been garbage. Yeah. And they haven't been appropriate for circumstances that the council are actually in. So, you know, because you can run one type of business doesn't necessarily mean to say you can run another type. And I think that the difference between running small private businesses and running a very large organisation like the council is starting to come home to some people.
Well, it's already well you criticising, but what would you do in his place?
Well, firstly, I would make certain that the cabinet actually have some degree of accountability, and that you have people in there who are in a position where they've got some degree of experience and are actually in a position to really question officers. I mean, I was doing some work today on a couple of the budget proposals, and it was absolutely obvious that no questions had actually been asked. And when I asked the officers about things, it all started spilling out. And
what sort of things are you talking about, rather than in
right,
a general
okay.
term?
Yeah. There's a proposal to not proceed with the recycling centre in South Bristol and the pool at Speedwell. And basically, the recycling centre, there was figures that had been put in front of the mayor and, in theory, in front of a working group, which were completely wrong. And I, because I've got experience in that area, I was able to show that they were wrong and actually properly challenge the decision that's got to be, you know, that the mayor was about to make.
Yeah, he's got a lot to do, hasn't he? You were saying he's got all these various different roles. How on earth is he going to have time to drill down as one person rather than as a party, you know, who you can spread the work a little bit into the detail of these proposals? I mean, I noticed also in the paper this week, Labour is urging George Ferguson to think again over this particular proposal at Speedwell Pool.
That's quite amusing, that, in actual fact, because it was only a couple of years ago that the Labour Party was saying that when we promised to deliver the pool that we were lying, and we were not, and we spent money on getting the early stages of that pool moving. It should have happened, and we will make certain that it does happen, because bluntly it is absolute lunacy to abandon that part way through, and we will be challenging that decision as well.
Well, Ron Stone from St George West, he said, he's a Labour councillor, said the new Bristol East pool built at Brunel Academy would add to the gym already there. It would be the only leisure centre for miles. We believe demand has been underestimated. We need this pool. The old one closed down prematurely in 2005. There are new pools in the north and the south of the city, and our families and children deserve equal opportunity with the rest of the city. We've already had successful pools run in partnership with the City Council. I'm confident we can get a workable deal for the new pool and the leisure centre. Martin, I mean, this is only one example, but I mean, this is basically the cuts kicking in now, isn't it?
Yeah, and what's interests me is that, say, Gary and other Liberal Democrats decide that they're going to oppose this decision and the Labour Party agrees with that, who will ultimately, I mean, at some point, will George Ferguson be outvoted on something like this in full cabinet, in full council?
Well, we're going to be looking for Labour, and it looks like on this issue, at least, they're going to be supporting us to actually reverse that decision from George and to make certain that the schemes, those two in particular, and the PCSOs, that the decision gets reversed. And if we have a significant majority in the budget debate, then he will have to modify his position.
It's not just a majority, though, is it? This new having a mayor situation is new for us all. I mean, he can override just a vote in full council, can't he? But he's got to get two-thirds to overturn or something.
Well, it's the rules are quite messy, but basically, if there's a majority to put a budget amendment through, then those budget amendments stand. Right. He can refuse to accept them for a short while, but he's then got to come back with a budget that's accepted by a majority of the council.
Right.
So if we've got logic...
That goes through on a majority vote, presumably.
On that particular part, yeah. So basically, I mean, on two or three of these issues, the Labour Party seem to be agreeing with us, which is fine. And I suspect we've obviously got to identify where the money's going to come from, but we'd already done that, and George has actually taken the money away from the sources that we actually provided to pay for this and spent it on other things.
Yes, pet projects, well, possibly, yeah. Yeah.
Well, one pet project, which I don't know if how much it's going to cost, but the Bristol Mayor, George Ferguson, has backed a £1.7 million crisis fund for the needy. A new £1.7 million fund will
come. Well, it's not new.
Crisis loans for people in desperate need. Well, this is the Evening Post saying it's
well,
new.
When did you ever start believing anything you read in the Evening Post?
Well,
come on now.
All I'm doing is quoting here.
Yeah.
Mayor Ferguson's given the Local Crisis and Prevention Fund his seal of approval after a recommendation at a meeting of his multi-party cabinet at City Hall last night, who didn't have a vote, but went along with George's consensus and shook his hand and said, yes, let's do this.
Yeah, basically, this is money that was handed out by central government, and the money's been transferred to local government to hand out instead. So it's not a new fund. It's just basically a means of redistributing it. The only thing that actually concerns me with regard to this, when this first came up about a year or so ago, we were very keen, actually, on having third sector organisations involved in the distribution of this and the administration of it, because a lot of them actually know rather better some of the, you know, low-level needs and have good contact.
So you're talking about things like Bristol Debt Advice Centre and this kind of thing?
Yeah, Citizens Advice Bureau, that sort of organisation. And basically, our initial thought, I haven't seen the reports back, our initial thoughts were that that sort of organisation might be better qualified to actually administer this sort of thing and might actually also be able to bring in extra resources and make the money go a bit further. But it seems that it's going to be done in-house.
The new fund will target people who are or have been homeless, people who've just left local authority care, ex-prisoners and those escaping domestic abuse. Martin, Cabinet Member Gus Hoyt, Green Party Ashley, told the meeting that the project was essential as the need for crisis loans was growing in Bristol. After the meeting, Mr. Hoyt told the Post, the new fund is absolutely critical. More and more people are facing hardship, so it's vital we provide the means that we have.
Well, I mean, it sounds as if it's a good thing, and I tend to agree with Gary that it might be better to decentralise some of the spending to people who've got, you know, hands-on experience of what they're dealing with. But as you, I didn't realise that this was money that central government used to distribute, presumably through job centres and things like that. Was that the original?
Through DWP, I believe. Yeah. So basically, it was central money that was put out. Yeah. Crisis.
So this is part of the localism agenda to give it to the council to distribute. Is it?
Well, it's one of the only things involved in real localism, I think. Yeah. I mean, most of localism seems to involve centralisation, but this is actually distribution from central government, so giving the power to the councils to spread this money out.
But it's loans, isn't it? I mean, you know, when somebody has got no money and absolutely desperate, isn't it a grant they need rather than a loan, Gary?
It depends on the circumstances. I mean, basically, if it can be done by loan, then you've got more money to revolve round and help more people. So I think there is discretion for grant as well. And basically, I think that, you know, we need to look at how it's used.
Martin, what do you think? I mean, surely if you've got no money at all, you're absolutely desperate and homeless, a loan is not actually going to help you a great deal, is it?
Yeah,
you really need. I mean, it's almost like the council becoming loan sharks. You know, these a lot of these kinds of amounts of money used to be dished out if someone could be proved to be in an absolutely crisis type situation, that it was a grant that you were given, and that would get you back, start getting you back onto, you know, getting housing, that kind of thing. This is almost like loan sharking. If these people can't get jobs and can't pay it, this loan surely is just going to grow and it's going to become a total burden to them, just as bad as before.
Well, hopefully not at loan shark rates of interest. I take the point that Gary made, that if you don't loan it, then you haven't got any more money to give out. But I mean, basically what we're talking about here is sticking plaster on a gaping wound, you know. This is, you know, small amounts of money to make up for all the other losses that people at the bottom are suffering at the moment.
Okay, on to our next story then. And whitewash storm as watchdog rules out petrol price inquiry because there was no evidence drivers were ripped off. Now, this must have raised eyebrows right across the country as the Office of Fair Trading announced that there was very limited evidence that prices were being kept high by the oil firms. Motoring groups accused the Office of Fair Trading of a whitewash after the watchdog ruled out a full inquiry into petrol prices, Martin.
Well, I mean, without looking at the detail, it's hard to argue about this, isn't it? I mean, if the Office of Fair Trading are doing their job properly, they should do a proper analysis and we should be able to believe what they say.
If you read through here, you'll see that, for example, independent retailers are saying that they are having to buy from wholesalers fuel at prices which are greater than the supermarkets, for example, are selling it. I mean, surely that's not fair trading.
Well, I think the existence of an Office of Fair Trading shows that the market on its own doesn't work, and you have to regulate it. The Office of Fair Trading have to go and look at it. Maybe they've made the wrong decision here. But the idea that the market will solve it is facetious.
I mean, ultimately, the supermarkets are allowed to charge less, and they can charge what they want, can't they? And sometimes the profit margins are very low because they see the fuel as a loss leader to get people in. And as a result, a lot of independent fuel retailers are just simply having to close.
Well, that just shows you that the market can come up with all sorts of solutions depending on how it's rigged, doesn't it?
Gary?
Well, I mean, I've looked at the figures on this, and basically nearly two-thirds of the cost is tax. Most of the rest is actually the cost of the crude oil, and it's about 11p out of 130p is actually for the margin of the retailers and the distribution. So basically, I think within that 11p, there's very limited scope for fiddling of the market. And I actually think that there's potentially some problem in the way that the crude oil is priced when it between actually being taken out of the ground and then sold on at that point. that's the area that's going to be looked at.
That's where the money's taken out.
Well, I mean, there was a story last year, wasn't there, about a kind of LIBOR fixing going on with these oil companies, saying, well, I'll tell you what, let's actually jack the price up altogether, all of us today, and just so that, you know, that the all the prices are kind of go up at the same time for the retailers. The other thing is, of course, that these individual retailers, even though it might say BP, are a separate part of the BP or whichever big oil company to the people who are actually doing the refining and transporting. So they say, oh, we don't make enough money on this. But if you look at the wider BP, they're making billions every minute. I mean, literally, well, certainly billions every week.
Well, I think the similarities with what happened with the pub trade are actually quite interesting, because some years ago, we were told by the Conservative government at that time that you had to get rid of the control of the breweries over pubs, and things would be massively better if they did that. What actually happened then was that there was a bit of a flurry, and there's still some small individual pubs that are very interested, but what's mainly happened is that we've moved away from breweries who had an interest in a good supply chain and getting good quality pubs, replaced by property dealers who haven't got any interest at all in the quality of service provided and just want to make some money out of the property.
Martin, we were told that by intervening in places like Iraq and Middle East that oil was going to be secure, it wasn't actually going to be going up in price, but it is. It's trickling up all the time. It's going up and up and up, isn't it, bit by bit?
Well, the oil market is a classic example of a market that doesn't function according to the textbook free market principles. You've got organisations like the Organisation of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which are restricting supply in order to push up the price. You've got big oil companies which collude, and then control political decisions about invasions and things. And the idea that the market is behind all of this, it's pretty right. This is geopolitics that determines the price of oil.
Well, also BP, I'm just looking up their latest profits. £1.3 million an hour they're making, so they're doing quite well. I mean, maybe they can just get rid of those margins a slight amount, and of course most of that is made at the wholesale level. So this is what I wanted to try and just get from you, Martin, is that these companies, what they've done is they've separated the retail bit, haven't they, from these part of the business that ships oil around the world, crude oil, and refines it, and that's where they're making the money. And that, of course, is a little bit like Starbucks. You know, they can then move those profits to wherever they want to
transfer pricing.
At the end of the day, the motorist is getting ripped off, even though the OFT says everything's fine.
And it's not just the motorist. The knock-on effect of your whole economy of having a distorted oil price is enormous. It's one of the two major prices in the economy. The interest rate and the oil price are not determined by any kind of free market interaction, and that's the reality. And of course the oil prices are also manipulated as part of geopolitical games. So I've read very interesting books in the last couple of years suggesting that the oil price was forced up during the 1980s to bring the Soviet Union to its knees, and forced down in the 1980s to bring the Soviet Union to his knees, and then forced up to bring the Chinese to heel. And that's the kind of thing that people sit around at the top tables talking about, and it's not determined by a free market in any straight way, shape or form.
Talking of geopolitical games and the people at the top table, at Davos last weekend, the BBC's Stephanie Flanders managed to buttonhole a certain Lloyd Blankfein. Now, he's the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, and unlike the rest of us, he's managed to get a pay increase this year of $20 million increase. That's not his salary, that's an increase of his salary. So let's have a listen to Stephanie Flanders now talking to Lloyd Blankfein.
What do you say to the people who say, we're still paying the price for this financial crisis, and the bankers who caused it have got scot-free?
You know, I don't know how to respond. I mean, there's a lot embedded in that assertion. I think there were, you know, certainly by our community, but there were a lot of excesses that existed before. I think we have and are playing a role in the development, and we still are in the business of attracting, recruiting, retaining, and frankly, rewarding talent for their efforts. And so we're going to play our part in improving the financial system. There are no doubt legacy burdens that we're all going to carry, and your question reflects a legacy burden, and we're not stepping aside from those and going to deal with it.
Well, but the legacy burden is that people are still cross.
People are still cross, well, you know, with you. They're still cross, and they want to sort it out. They want to understand. They want to make sure that the world, including the private sector, the public sector, the government sector, doesn't over-leverage itself again and doesn't run those kinds of risks again. But at the same time, I think we are going to try to spend an increasing amount of our thoughts in trying to look forward, not to dismiss the past. We'll deal with those legacy issues, but to get the economies of the world going so companies can grow, people can earn higher salaries, and more people can be employed.
Well, he's sounding very positive. Maybe he's paid to do that. 20 million extra this year. He's paid to do it. That's Lloyd Blankfein there. I mean, do you think he lives in the same world as us, Gary?
Well, it's on the same planet. I think what's got to be recognised, though, is that people are in business to make money. That's what his job is, to make money for his shareholders. The problem with the economic crisis that actually happened was that banks did what banks will do if they can get away with it.
But he's saying
and basically, it's the fault of governments that the whole system was allowed to get completely out of control.
But he's saying now that they are working to improve the financial system, and also he's very bullish, very positive at Davos. Things are looking up.
Well, in actual fact, the profitability of a lot of the big companies is moving up. That isn't necessarily the whole story, though, because we're not seeing that wealth being spread around as widely as it could be. And so the system is succeeding a little bit, but there are still massive problems. And I don't think that governments around the world have yet got to grips with what they really need to do. Some countries have got it cracked. They've got the systems and the management and the control of economic policy that actually works. Sweden's a good example.
And Iceland, we'll be hearing from in a minute. Martin, but Lloyd Blankfein there is talking about, he's really explaining the bonuses. He's saying that they're recruiting and rewarding talent. I mean, that's what businesses are supposed to do, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I also remember he was saying at the height of the crisis that he was doing God's work. He's an ideologue. The fact is, without government stepping in to bail out the system, including him, it would all have gone down the drain. So, of course, what's happened with the bailouts, if they've gone, yippee, we don't have to worry about going bust because the government will bail us out. So they've gone back to the gaming tables, and we're seeing a massive speculative bubble on the back of the government bailout. And I agree with Gary that what should have happened, when governments bailed them out, they should have been asserting their power over them. But nobody was ready for that. Well, they weren't prepared mentally to deal with these people, and they're still not.
Well, they're not, and they should have been involved far earlier, not allowing it to get to that situation where we needed these huge bailouts, and there were people giving warnings.
Well, that goes back to the 1980s and the deregulation of these markets, which in hindsight was a pretty stupid thing to do, but at the time everybody thought it was wonderful, including right across the political spectrum.
Well, let's hear right from the opposite end of the political spectrum, that is to say from Olafur Ragnar Grimsson, who's the president of Iceland. And by the way, Iceland this week were exonerated, weren't they, on Monday in the international courts, saying that actually there was no problem whatsoever with them deciding they weren't going to pay the debts, because they said that there was criminal activity going on within their banks. They arrested many of the bankers over in Iceland, and they have now been given essentially a pat on the back by the courts and said that you did the right thing.
I think it surprises a lot of people that 4 years ago we were exhibit number one of a failed financial system. But now we are back on recovery with economic growth and very little unemployment. And I think the primary reason is that we were wise enough to realize this was also a fundamental social and political crisis. But above all, we didn't follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western world in the last 30 years. We introduced currency controls, we let the banks fail, we provided support for the poor, we didn't introduce austerity measures of the scale you're seeing here in Europe. And the end result, 4 years later, is that Iceland is enjoying progress and recovery very different from the other European countries that suffered from the financial crisis. As I'm often asked, why do they consider the banks to be the holy churches of the modern economy? Why are private banks not like airlines and telecommunication companies allowed to go bankrupt if they have been conducted in an irresponsible way? The theory that you have to bail out banks is a theory about bankers enjoying for their own profit the success and then letting ordinary people bear the failure through taxes and austerity. And people in enlightened democracies are not going to accept that in the long run. One thing we learned after the collapse of the banks in Iceland, that the Icelandic banks, like the British and the Americans and other banks, have in fact become high-tech companies, hiring engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists. And when they failed, the innovative sectors of our economy, the IT sector, the high-tech sector, in fact blossomed and have been doing much better in the last 3 years than ever before. So the lesson of that is that if you want your economy to be competitive in the innovative sector of the 21st century, a strong financial sector that takes the talent from these sectors, is even a successful financial sector, is in fact bad news if you want your economy to be competitive in the areas which really are the 21st century areas, innovation, technology, IT.
Now that's Olafur Ragnar Grimsson, a leader of the Icelandic Hobbits, taking on the vampire squid of Goldman Sachs. Martin, I mean, he's saying there currency controls and also no austerity at all in Iceland, the opposite in fact.
Yeah, I mean, the Icelandic success has also been built on the fact that they basically refused to cover the deposits held by British and Dutch nationals in their system, so that the British and Dutch governments had to step in and bail out their nationals who were going to lose money. And that meant, for example, a lot of local authorities in this country. So and also another clarification, the Icelanders have not refused to pay the debt completely. They've said we're only going to pay it insofar as we are able to pay it. We're not trying to walk away from the debts that we owe to the British and Dutch governments, but we're not going to pay it back in any kind of timescale, which is going to mess up our own internal plan for recovery. And I think you can see the difference between a political system like Iceland, which has only got like 300,000 people, that's the size of Bristol, and the responsiveness of it. You know, they've got PR, you know, the government can be kicked out and then replaced and so on. I mean, what we've got is, if you imagine, the city of London has been sitting in London since the 16th, 17th century, and the political power they have over whoever is running the government here is enormous and remains so.
Gary, what about Grimsson's point there about letting the banks fail like they would any other business? He's talking about airlines. I mean, we've had businesses fail right across the city. We've had, for example, we closed down a Filton Airfield, companies who aren't able to necessarily carry on there. We were talking last week about the possibility of Airbus having to pull out. We're seeing some quite big businesses go down. We've seen, on the high street, we've seen the most obvious ones. We've seen Jessop's, we've seen Cadbury's taken over. I mean, these companies, they kind of fail and they, we end up with an empty building. But it doesn't seem to happen with the banks, and that seems to be the point he's making there. Why is that?
Yeah, the point is, though, as Martin's actually saying, it's a very small economy. What should have happened is that the management and control from government shouldn't have allowed the banks to get into a position where they were so large that they could bring down countries, which basically is what would actually happen. If you're in the case of Iceland, if they say, sorry, we can't manage this, wipe your slate clean, we start again, which is more or less what's actually happening, it doesn't affect the world economy that much. They've got an economy probably smaller than Bristol's. But if the same happened with the major financial institutions that have arms all over the world, then basically you would have had a situation where Greece would have looked like a picnic. You know, we'd have been in major problems. The problem that we have in this country and in the States and a number of other countries is that we allowed the banks to get so large that it was impossible to let them fail.
It's not just that. It's also, in 1998, long-term capital management failed in the US, which was a hedge fund, which was set up by Myron Scholes, who invented the derivatives market and all the rest of it. And the shadow banking market is bigger by many times than the world economy. Now, that should never have been allowed to happen.
Absolutely.
And when long-term capital management failed, that's one hedge fund, and they'd been operating for about 18 months. The whole financial system of the world was in danger of collapse, and the US government had to step in and pick up the tab for one tiny little hedge fund. Now, that is the problem with the financial innovation system that we've developed. It's actually innovated to the point where it's become an incredibly fragile pack of cards.
Many people will say it's a bad idea to invest in Icelandic banks because we've seen certain people lose their money. Some councils, it looks like, have lost their money through investing in Iceland.
No, we're likely to get it back.
They'll get it back in the end.
All I'm saying is...
maybe.
Doesn't it look now that the opposite, that actually Iceland is probably a safer place to keep your money than many of the other banks?
But bizarrely enough, Iceland didn't have any private banks at all until 2003, I think. They had two banks which were owned by the Icelandic government, and they were very boring. Icelandic people put their money in the bank and then took it out. The profit margins were minimal because they're basically public institutions for public purposes. And then, of course, the wide boys came along and said, you don't want to be doing that. You want to be doing some of this.
And now they're in jail.
And a few, yes, exactly.
Gary, you're absolutely right on the population. I mean, we've got, I think it's officially 350,000 people in Bristol. Iceland is 320,000 people. But Martin, I mean, what lessons have we got to learn from Mr. Grimson? Because surely there must be something.
I think the main lesson that you would draw from this is that they increased unemployment benefits in Iceland because they've got a large number of people who are in danger of unemployment or going to be unemployed or were unemployed. And of course, in a small country like that with a PR system where it's very responsive, you know, a large section of the electorate might be unemployed, so unemployment benefits don't go down, they go up. And in actual fact, that protects your economy, it doesn't undermine it. And I think the attempt to cut benefits in Britain is entirely misguided. I think that's what I mainly draw from what
he said. Back to the Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons now, and Gavin Schruker was talking about the way that the government debt is actually up $600 billion. That's coming on for a trillion. So let's have a listen to that question on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions now.
Gavin Schruker! Last week the Prime Minister said that he was paying down Britain's debt, but on his watch it will go up by £600 billion. Would he like to take the opportunity to correct the record?
Yeah. I'm very clear, we have got the deficit down by a quarter, and in order to get on top of our debts you have to get on top of the deficit. That is stage one of getting on top of our debts. But it is worth reminding ourselves why we're having to do this in the first place. Who was it who racked up the debts? Who was it who racked up the deficit? Who was it who gave us the biggest deficit of any country virtually anywhere in the world? It was the government which he supported.
Well, it was, wasn't it, Martin? It was your party, the Labour Party, actually, that racked up this massive debt. And now what they're doing is, as the first stage towards bringing that debt down, which is actually going up, as you said there, now by £600 billion, the first thing to do is to address the deficit.
That's... no, because the problem with addressing the deficit too quickly, it's like driving a car across an ice pan. If you try and address the deficit too quickly by stabbing on the brake, what you do is turn the car over. And what you've actually got to do is drive into... In other words, if you go too far too fast, the likelihood is you end up in a situation where the economy is actually shrinking, which is where we are now, and the deficit goes up anyway. The deficit has been coming down since the coalition came to power, but what may have happened in the last 2 months is it started to go up again as a result of the economy getting into...
What is the difference between debt and deficit? Let me clarify some of this. The debt is the actual total national debt. That's the amount of money that the government...
That's the total
owes.
Amount, yeah.
The deficit, how is that different?
The deficit is what the government borrows year on year, or, you know, quarter on quarter.
Okay, so the difference between what they're getting in taxes and what they're having to borrow to add to that in public spending.
And also that you then have to think of the debt and the deficit in terms of your GDP as well. So, you know, I'll just give you a figure here which I looked up. Total public sector debt when the coalition took over was 811 billion, which was 55% of that GDP at the time. That was in the second quarter of 2010. Now, the total debt is $111 billion, which is 70% of GDP. Now, that sounds terrible, but, I mean, in actual fact, other countries, the US has got 75% of GDP, Italy something like 100%, Japan is 120%. The real issue here is, should we have gone so fast at cutting the deficit if the cost is going to be at the expense of growth? And if you, because once you get into a situation where there's no growth, you're in a kind of debt trap where further austerity simply increases the debt. Now, I don't think we'd be talking that much differently if the Labour Party had won the last election, because the facts of the situation don't change that much, and we've ended up with a massive debt and deficit as a result of the collapse.
But
the
ratings agencies, this is the key, isn't it? They're looking at Britain as, is this a good place to invest? And the ratings agencies are actually still saying we're a pretty good bet.
We probably will lose our credit rating this year, which will be an embarrassment for the government, but it won't necessarily be a disaster for the country.
Okay, Gary, are you into this macroeconomic stuff? Do you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. It's partly what I do for a living, apart from being a counsellor.
Which is?
Well, I'm a financial advisor as well as actually being a counsellor.
Okay.
And basically, the fact is that the previous government were spending huge amounts on day-to-day spending. If you like, it's, you know, borrowing to pay the credit card bill, and that's not good news. Where this government made a serious mistake, in my view, is that they actually have failed to make capital investment as early as they should have done. So basically, there's a difference between borrowing to build something and borrowing to continue on day-to-day spending. And I think that they've got the balance wrong on that. And borrowing for real investment is the sort of thing that should be done when you've got an economic difficulty. Now, I mean, what the government have managed to do is to reduce the rate at which the total debt has been going up. That's all they've done.
Yes, although in the last couple of months it started to slide, and which is why the question is, I mean, it may only be a couple of months.
Yeah.
And it may be that the downward trend of the deficit, despite everything else, will continue. But I suspect we're reaching a turning point now.
Yeah.
And that in actual fact, the deficit will go up as happened where you get Greece.
The latest
places,
figures,
you know,
for December are the deficit looks like it's going up again. So it does sort of agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, but I mean, that's only 1 month's figures.
Yeah.
A trend doesn't come from 1 or 2 months' figures. But yeah. I think it's a straw in the wind, because if you get into a situation where your deficit's going up because the economy is tanking, then you're in a real nasty situation that's very difficult to get out of.
I think the criticism that sticks most clearly against the previous government is that, you know, sometimes government needs to borrow to invest. That's very much the case. But when we had benign economic circumstances, they were borrowing to fund current expenditure, and that was very, very dangerous.
Yeah, but most of the debt that has been run up, though, is since the crisis broke. It's not, you know, and it's been willy-nilly forced through as a result of the crisis.
There was borrowing before.
Oh, yes, I accept that they were over-borrowed, but, I mean, the other thing is that we've actually eviscerated the tax collection system over 30 years under New Labour and the Conservatives. Mm. I mean, and basically, if you eviscerate the tax system, all you've got left is borrowing,
well,
isn't it?
One of the things that came out over Christmas, I don't know if you noticed, Gary, was this deal with Switzerland to get back money being kept, a tax of evasion, essentially, secretly in Swiss bank accounts by individuals in Britain. And there's a deal being done between George Osborne and the Swiss now. I was just hearing this week from Dominic Laurie on 5 Live that there are all sorts of little clauses in this agreement with Osborne that means that actually a lot of that money that is being kept secretly by, because they haven't declared it in their tax declarations that they've got this money in Switzerland, is a lot of that money people aren't going to be being taxed on. Ultimately, you know, as a financial advisor, are you advising people to put their money in Switzerland and these tax havens, places where it can't be taxed?
No, because that, if you're doing it that way and they're not declaring it, it's illegal. And, you know, I'm not allowed to do that.
But
there are others who are doing it. But I think the biggest problem, though, is that there are some measures now being brought forward to deal with rich individuals. But what the country is completely failing to do is to fully get to grips with corporate tax avoidance. And really, you've got to face up to the reality, the fact that, you know, with the likes of Starbucks, whatever, if they're operating in this country, making their profits here, they should be taxed on those profits that are made here, not allowed to transfer the profits somewhere else where they pay less tax. And it doesn't require necessarily international agreement on that, because it's perfectly simple, straightforward, that the Inland Revenue should be in a position saying, no, you made your profits here, you get taxed on those profits here.
Martin, what about this point on the Swiss? Because this is really important, that if there's an agreement, I mean, we talked about this previously, that it's actually undermined an international agreement that the Germans were trying to forge with the Swiss and the EU. And that actually what it means is there's lots of get-out clauses for people to, so they don't have to actually declare the money that they've got in Switzerland.
Well, you'd have thought if people are breaking the law, as Gary pointed out, they should be prosecuted, and at that point they should be penalised. Really penalised. If we're going to send people to prison for stealing a bottle of water in a riot, if you're shown to be stealing from the taxpayer up to, you know, we're talking millions here, maybe you need to go to prison. And that's the only thing that's going to deter these people.
OK, on to the next story. BBC are telling us that the Great Western London to South West Rail Contest has been scrapped. A competition to run the Great Western Rail franchise between South Wales and London is being scrapped. The UK Transport Secretary, Patrick McLoughlin, said he wants to negotiate an interim franchise of at least 2 years with current operator First Group. Now, I don't know about you, Gary, but this seems like a sort of quid pro quo for the situation with the North West Main Line, where First Group was supposedly won the franchise, and then it was found to be a dodgy deal, and then it's been handed for 2 years, funnily enough, the same amount of time, back to Virgin. So this franchise, the main one between Bristol and London, is not actually going to be up for competition.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is complete shambles, isn't it? Previous and this government haven't known what they're doing with this. The rules with regard to railways, far too complicated, far too fragmented, and quite bluntly, the whole thing is a mess.
Well, I totally agree with that. I mean, New Labour had, what is it, 13 years in power to get a grip on it?
Yep, failed to do it completely.
And they were unprepared to nationalise the railways, which there's a fairly clear majority in public opinion for renationalisation of the railways. They could have actually made a virtue of that and said, right, that's what we're going to do. But the policy was, oh, well, that's not going to be a priority. We've got other things like health and education we want to spend money on. We don't want to spend money on buying back the railways. But as soon as the banks wobble, then the chequebook comes out. And this is what people can see. Nationalisation is never going to happen. That era's over, apart from for banks. And well, of course, that's just ridiculous.
There were five businesses in the running for taking over from First Group. One of them was First Group, reapplying for their franchise. National Express, Stagecoach and Arriva, and also a division of the German railways, Deutsche Bahn, were all bidding for the franchise, which now is no longer going to happen. But, I mean, it just seemed like this really is, it's kind of some sort of sop to First Group, Gary.
I don't think it's done in that way. I think it's the position that with Virgin having demonstrated that the whole system has not been properly managed, it would be very difficult for the government to stand by the arrangements to be made on our franchise here, because quite frankly the losing bidders would challenge it. So they've got to completely redesign the bidding process before they can make any progress.
Yeah, when we're arguing about which shark should run it, when perhaps we should just, you know, run it ourselves.
OK, back now to some of the effects of the cuts around the country, and back to Prime Minister's questions again. And this is a question from Gavin Schruker. Oh, sorry, no, from Frank Royd about food banks.
Frank Royd. Last week the Prime Minister described blacklisting as a completely unacceptable practice. Why is it this week still blacklisting food banks by refusing to have the decency to visit the food banks, to listen, to actually speak? Well, the other side may find it funny, but thousands of families don't. Will the Prime Minister visit a food bank to actually speak to the people who use them?
I think maybe we need to modernise the system. So if you get a whips question, you can get it on a tablet or an iPad, so you can change it as question time proceeds. But of course, I look forward to having those discussions. discussions with the people who operate food banks and those who use food banks. But as I said, use of them grew 10 times under the last Labour government, and instead of attacking them, I think we should praise the people that give of their time to work in these organisations.
I don't think he was actually attacking a food bank by saying the Prime Minister should visit one. Gary, what are your thoughts about this business? Because this is coming up every week at Question Time now. It's almost like a slow machine gun against Mr Cameron, saying you have got to visit one of these food banks to see the effect of your policies.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the aspects of politics that people don't like very much, really. It's both sides of that exchange, playing the political game rather than actually addressing the subject. There are significant numbers of people who have real difficulty with their finances, and food banks provide a very valuable service in some areas, and basically, rather than playing games with it, I think there should be proper examination and proper support.
But why is it playing a game to ask the Prime Minister to visit a food bank?
Well, I think that firstly, we had the bit about the blacklisting, which is a completely different subject, and basically it's pointing a finger. We all know that the Prime Minister is regarded as a posh boy who doesn't know the price of milk, and a member from his own party actually saying that. But I think that the question could be put in a rather more penetrating way, that rather than concentrating on the image of the Prime Minister, they actually get to the root cause of what's been done about the subject.
Martin, why is it, do you think, that Mr Cameron hasn't visited a food bank?
Well, probably because his advisers have decided that if he goes to a food bank, he might meet demonstrators or something like that. I can't imagine what the reason is.
Well, it's not the greatest photo opportunity, is it? Really?
No, I mean, but this is basically, I mean, because we have prime ministerial politics attacking the personality of the Prime Minister and whether he's in touch with people and so on is the way in which these kind of exchanges are conducted. And as you know, Tony, I'm no great fan of Prime Minister's questions for that very reason. It's basically a sort of a Punch and Judy show which insults the intelligence of the electorate.
Well, but it's also a way of reminding everybody of a specific topic, like food banks.
Well, yes.
Because often these kind of things drop off the mainstream press agenda, don't they? Anyway, on to our last story this week, and fears over a new generation of Brat Pack police chiefs after the government scraps the rules forcing recruits to serve as beat bobbies. Downing Street's changing rules about running UK police forces, the rule forcing recruits to join as a police constable, will be scrapped to attract high flyers. The 20 to 25 years it takes to reach the top jobs would also be halved. Gary,
I think there is a case for entry at slightly different levels, but I still have an awful lot of concerns about this. If you're a senior police officer, you're asking people to take risks, to put themselves in danger, to do lots of things on behalf of all of us, and I think if they haven't done it themselves, there is a significant danger in that sort of approach, and it really worries me to have the consultants from KPMG or whatever coming wandering into an organisation like the police force and thinking they can actually do it. They can't.
There's this chap called Bill Bratton, who's called a super cop from Los Angeles, but if you actually look at his record, it's not a particularly good one. He's often trumpeted by the Daily Mail and other newspapers and other press as an amazing figure. If we bring him into London, he will completely transform London policing. But his record with the Los Angeles police, Martin, isn't actually that good. And what about this principle of bringing people in from other countries to take over police forces, implanting them in right at the very top level?
Well, I think policing in particular is very specific to individual communities, smaller communities, and to individual countries. And the internal culture, you could say, well, it's a bit rigid and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, it gives continuity, stability. People know where they are. And as Gary says, how can somebody order people to do what are potentially very dangerous things if they've never done them themselves? There's going to be a morale issue there, isn't there? And I think it's fairly clear that senior police and junior police officers are not happy with this at all. We should listen to them.
Okay, but Gary, do you think this is likely to? I mean, if you know, would you be disturbed if, say, an American like Bill Bratton was brought in to take over? Even I mean, I know we've just got a new chief constable, but to take over when he leaves, for example.
I'm significantly worried. I mean, we've got a new chief constable appointed in Bristol. There's been enough controversy about that, as it happens, with regard to the police and crime commissioner positions, and I really worry that. Very often what works in business does not necessarily work in public service.
Absolutely.
And quite often they require completely different approaches. That's okay. What worries me about this.
Okay, well, thanks very much. That was Lib Dem Councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Join me after the news where we talk about Turkey.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, two hitmen who went to the wrong house have been found guilty of...